Everyone ready?
I'm ready. Heck yeah, I'm ready.
Awesome.
Born ready.
Okay, well, Chris, hit it. Hit the new theme song.
Boop, 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 boop.
Hello?
Yeah, is that it? I'm working on like a mouth slap face intro to it. I'm sorry, guys.
Dude, we're close. We're so close. So welcome to the second episode of Shop Talk, a live podcast with myself, Dave Rupert, and Chris Coyer. And today we have a special guest who you probably know. It's Mr. Paul Irish. Paul, thanks so much for coming out today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is going to be great.
We got a big show ahead of us, talking shop and shop things. Not about shopping, as some people regrettably tuned in for. This is not a podcast about shopping. But yeah, Chris, do you have any hot drama this week?
Hot drama. This is a new section we're talking about doing. There's always some good web drama to talk about. I feel like you were more into it this week, right? Do you got something? Maybe you should just.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So I guess the big thing this week is SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. We just want to say welcome Reddit and Wikipedia users. Since you have nothing to do today, you no doubt turned out to listen to this podcast, which I guess we are emphatically in support of SOPA. No, that is not that is a falsehood. Good luck and thanks everyone for shutting down your websites so people would come here. I think that's what we want to say. That's our final word. And
we got
a lot of sort of a mini news segment related to news. We want to give the Site of the Week award to Akko.net.
Ooh, yeah.
For his use of most extreme CSS3 WebGL usage ever. So, good job. Paul, you saw it, obviously. What do you think of it?
It was really rad. It uses, what's his name? Stephen Witten, I think. And so what he did is he decided that he wanted to kind of create somewhat of a 3D space inside the masthead of his site that manipulates as you scroll. And the best part is that he actually ended up making a new renderer for 3.js, which already has renderers to WebGL, 2D Canvas, and SVG. And so he built out a fourth renderer for it and 3D transforms, which that little fact kind of got overlooked, but that's actually a pretty huge undertaking and is going to expose a lot of new possibilities to people. So the other cool thing is that on his site, on the post that I think it's called Making Love to WebKit, he has a little editor at the bottom where you can kind of manipulate the 3D scene and add new stuff to it. And if you do that, the editor or the masthead at the top responds live. So you can kind of like tweak his existing masthead and play around with it, which is pretty rad. Yeah, it's hot.
I saw the renderer, but I didn't know it was that cool. Gold star, Steven.
Woo! No, this was pretty cool. And some people were like, dude, this is just total like pornography or what, like this is totally impractical. And I'm like, hell yeah, it is. It's awesome.
Yeah. I took off my pants.
Dude, it was cool.
ACKO.net for those trying to find it that only are listening.
Yeah, I guess it's a tough spelling.
It was cool before. That site was cool before, but now it's really cool. It always had that kind of 3D waterfall-y thing going on. Anyway.
Yeah.
You got a question, Dave? Let's kick it off with a...
Hey, I do. This question, actually, I mean, we take submitted questions if you submit them, but this question actually happened in a bar last night through a conversation with our I think he's all our friends, Mike Taylor, nice. Who's an opera evangelist. And then we'll make opera evangelist and the Chrome evangelist wage war later. But so he's Mike Taylor. He came and we were talking, and we just asked the question, why do Pokemon masters love JavaScript? Why do Pokemon masters love JavaScript? Anyone? Because you gotta try catch 'em all. Up top, man, that is a good joke. Oh my gosh. You gotta try catch 'em all.
Oh, oh my god.
They're not gonna be that good, y'all be.
Yeah. That's so good. No, thankfully I went to the bar last night and got some great joke content for this week. Can't guarantee that every week.
Good one, Mike.
Wow.
Well, let's get into actual serious questions, shall we?
Sure. We have some MP3 questions this week, which is super cool. Keep those coming in, guys. It's nice to hear your voices, and it just makes for a more interesting radio program.
Yeah, it's probably our preferred question-taking device. So I'm going to attempt for the very first time in Shop Talk history to pipe an MP3 into this Skype call. Are you guys ready? I'm, like, nervous. I'm shaking. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Alex. I'm a web developer at Dialect on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, Canada. My question is about JavaScript libraries for mobile web development. With all these really capable WebKit-based browsers on mobile devices, I'm wondering, are people still including jQuery and bringing in that huge library with all its compatibility layers? Are they accessing the DOM directly with JavaScript? Or is there maybe some sort of lightweight in-between library that still gives you some of that syntactic sugar and chaining and all that goodness that you get from jQuery without all the unnecessary compatibility stuff that they keep in for IE6 and friends? That's my question. Thanks a lot.
Okay, should we defer to the jQuery core team member first?
Just because I feel like Paul will have things to say about this. I heard that a lot of the compatibility stuff in jQuery isn't actually IE6. It's like Safari, an older Safari and stuff like that, and that there's not that much in jQuery that's like specific to IE6. But anyway, Paul can speak to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, so in fact, so a lot of people have asked, specifically on IE6, when will jQuery stop supporting it, and so that we can remove all that stuff. The big thing there, yeah, is that 7 shares just about every bug that's fixed in jQuery. So we would have to be removing support for IE6 and 7. That kills off a lot of Sizzl, the CSS selector engine, which is pretty sizable, but not huge. But in fact, yeah, there is a lot for some legacy Safari in there that has a lot of fixes. In fact, I think this last week, one of the newest developers that is working on jQuery Core, his name is Mike Sherov. He just decided that he was going to start to catalog absolutely every feature test and code fork in jQuery and identify what browser version it's for, what the test is, and so that we can get an idea of when we do sunset support for old legacy versions, what code paths are dead. Because right now it's kind of unknown a little bit in some cases. So that's going to be good. But as to the question, which is mobile WebKit. jQuery isn't that big, which I guess would be my first thing. So it's, 40-ish K min and gzipped. So there's that. It's not enormous. But yeah, it is not like 4K. So sometimes you might not want all the functionality in it, and that's fine. But then your project might grow, and then you do, and then so you want it. So there's a few projects that have existed to try and tackle a subset of what jQuery does and provide a similar API. The projects that come to mind right now are Zepto, XUI, and JQ.mobi, which is the brand new one, which is weird. JQ.mobi. You can look at the source code, but it's not. They got some room to work on it, I think. But Zepto and XUI have been around for a while, have a pretty good community, and are worth checking out if file size is dramatically important to you. My larger issue is that I think this is actually huge, which is we as JavaScript developers focus on file size way too much, specifically on JavaScript file size. And like, if we were that critical of the number of HTTP requests and the file size of images that are going into our sites and apps, that would be a lot better use of our time. A few K in JavaScript is really good. And one extra HTTP request for like an extra script file because you did not concatenate your jQuery plugins or whatever, that is dramatically more costly. So I would much more... I'd much rather see people focus on the larger performance picture, which matters a lot in the mobile case at the network layer. So number of HTTP requests and optimizing your waterfall. And so that is exactly where I would start optimizing, not with let's find a library that is a subset of jQuery.
Yeah.
Good answer. I would say I'm still using jQuery mostly because I do a lot of the responsive work. And so that I need a desktop, you know, environment and a mobile sort of at the same time. So I'm very comfortable like using jQuery, and the benefit of all that backward compatibility with IE8, because somebody's going to ask for that support, really comes in handy. So
yeah,
I would say I vote for keep using it.
Me too. I think Alex specifically mentions like, are people still accessing the DOM or something like that in the question? I'm like, I think so.
I don't know what you're doing if you're not.
If you absolutely don't need to access the DOM at all, then you probably don't need a library at all. That's
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on so we can do more questions.
Yeah, more.
I have one from Mike Thomas, who is just kind of a direct question to Paul. That's kind of interesting. That I bet that I don't know the answer to. That it's just maybe it's too personal. So feel free to pass on it. He wants to know
what is your net worth. No.
How long is it, Paul? He just wants to know how you got the job at Google, basically. Did they come gunning for you, or did you apply?
So I think here's what happened. I was never able to confirm all the parts of this. But around 2 years ago or so, a little over 2 years ago was when I started getting a lot more involved. I joined the jQuery team, and I also joined the Modernizer team to take over the development of the project, and got very engaged in that space. And I think part of it was actually Mark Pilgrim, who was the developer advocate, who was actually on the Chrome team specifically. I think he kind of noticed that. And soon enough, I got an email from the manager of the Chrome developer relations team being like, "Sup?" And I was like, "How you doing?" And they were like, "Yo," they're like, "Do you want to, talk to developers about how to build HTML5 and make it a reality?" And I was like, "I'm pretty sure that's what I want all of my free time to be doing, and if you as Google want to pay me to do it, well, that sounds just peachy." So it was just kind of a very fortuitous set of circumstances that led me to here.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's cool. Did they give you a Google puzzle? Can you talk about that? Did they say how do you fit 100 people into a box that's 4 foot by 2 foot?
Can you bubble sort your way out of it?
I didn't get any crazy brain teaser questions in my interviews like that. One of the hardest questions that I got was, I think it's called the dining philosopher's problem, where essentially you have a round table, you're hosting people for dinner, and you want to optimize the happiness of that table. And you know the sentiment of how everyone feels about everyone else, +1, -1, 0, and you want to find the optimal seating layout for that for the table, for so that everyone's happy. And I was like, I love this. I like making people happy. So this is the best. But the question was actually pretty hard. So that was a fun one. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Interesting. Awesome. Well, should we keep moving on, guys? We got more questions. Let's drive on through. Timothy Miller wrote in, and he said, so SVG is becoming more mainstream after years of obscurity. Do you see it overtaking raster graphics someday? Do you think it'll ever replace HTML?
HTML?
Like you're just doing all your stuff in SVG, not even rendering HTML.
Cool. So I think it was the other day, there was a really nice article on Sebastian Magazine, and it basically promoted SVG as a way to make scalable graphics that respond well in a responsive design type environment. And I think this is really rad. And I'd like to see more of it, of taking, you know, iconography that can scale up and down sizes. Of course, I think a lot of people want to have pixel control when you get down to something, you know, between like 10 and 20 pixels. Just knowing what the pixels are, and so going raster in those cases might make sense for you. But I think SVG could see a lot more use in this particular use case. The nounproject.com is a pretty amazing site when it comes to I want to put SVG on my site and you want iconography. It is the best. It's not going to overtake raster for, I don't know. I mean, CSS, like CSS gradients and the image generators, if only we could get noise in CSS, that would be pretty powerful. But we will. It'll just be a while. So raster and vector both have their place.
You heard it here first. News.
Noise. Breaking. Eventually. Breaking.
They both have their place. SVG is going to... The nice thing is that SVG goes into HTML very well, and I can apply CSS to my SVG and kind of tweak it. And we haven't yet seen too many people experimenting with how that works, but I'd like to see more of that for sure.
Yeah, I can speak to SVG and just that, like, I'm a good candidate for, like, I wish I knew more about it. I would, you know, like if somebody's like, hey, make a SVG star for me quick, dude, can you hook me up? And I'd be like, can Illustrator export as SVG?
It can.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I would probably go for. You know, like the tools aren't quite there yet, or the information isn't like super widespread yet. It would like, I don't, you know, I get why it's cool. I get that it's scalable vector graphics. I get that you can do a bunch of cool stuff for it, but it's not yet in my like go-to instant at mind knowledge of how to make websites. Right. So, yeah, the tools could be better.
I feel the same way about Canvas. It's like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. One day I'll use that for real.
Yeah.
My favorite for SVG, for a long time, I thought Raphael. When I saw Raphael.js do morphing between shapes and like morphing between like an infinity sign to a heart, and it was just like gorgeous and beautiful, I was like, wow, that's the power of SVG. And more lately, I've been looking at D3.js, which is the visualization library, which has just some incredible demos, really showing off the power of vector and the ability to kind of morph shapes and things like that. And so if anyone wants to kind of skip right into making experiences and skip over like learning SVG syntax, I would jump into those libraries.
Right on.
Cool.
So it is still something that needs a helper, you know, like... SVG means SVG is a technology, and then you need a helper for it.
Yeah. You don't want to be hand-coding SVG, for sure.
There you go. Cool. Let's move on to let's do another audio one. What do you say there?
Yeah, awesome.
One queued up on the fancy soundboard.
I got it on the Call-O-Matic 5000 here. This one's from John Stube. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. I am just recording this in response to Chris's Sprite Right giveaway post. A couple things I think would be kind of cool to hear, or at least one thing, is I know people are, the buzzword going around right now is responsive design this, responsive design that, but I think one of the things that a lot of people don't necessarily really talk about is kind of integrating CSS3 animations and things like that with it. And I don't know how much you guys could talk about that, you know, as it's an audio podcast type thing, but I think it would be really cool to hear about, Chris, what you've done on CSS tricks with CSS3 animations, with the media queries and that type of thing. And yeah, so that would be my question.
Thanks, John. Yeah, what he was referring to in that specific case, I guess, is that, like, you can... All right, so let's talk specifically about CSS and CSS transformations. So let's say you have like a link and it's red, and then on the hover state for that link, you change it to black. So when you hover it over it, if you have your CSS transform set up correctly, that red will like fade to black, right? That's the like the simplest way to explain a CSS transformation. And that change is triggered by the hover event in CSS. And so, but there's lots of things that can be that trigger. So that trigger might be like JavaScript or something adds a class to that element, which changes the color to black. And with the transform set up correctly, it will still do the fade to black. Well, another trigger can be a media query, can be that the styles change because a new set of media queries is taking place. And it's just what he's talking about is on CSS tricks, there's a few transitions that are triggered by media queries. So that's what he's talking about there. Yes, you can do that. It's pretty cool. It's kind of like an Easter egg thing because, you know, like in the greater world of web browsing, I'm not sure tons and tons of people are like constantly, you know, resizing their browser window. But it's cool. You know, why not? It's kind of a neat little Easter egg kind of thing. But John's question in a larger state was that how do CSS animations and transitions relate to responsive design? In general, I think, you know, when people talk about responsive design, they're talking about what can we do on smaller screens for better or worse. Mm-hmm. I think a good kind of rule of thumb is to turn a lot of that stuff off, on especially on the sizes that get down to mobile devices. Just kind of have some rules that like turn off your CSS animations and transitions, largely because they're, you know, I don't know. I hate to speak so generally like that, but a lot of times they're just unneeded. Like there is no hover event, so you might as well not have them at all. And animations can take up battery life and stuff like that. I bet Paul has some stuff to say about that, though. I know a long time ago there was a Paul post that was like, use request animation frame, and then your battery is better.
Yeah, I think so. In addition to kind of shutting things down, request animation frame is key, although it hasn't landed in any more browsers, but we'll be seeing it really soon, I think. Also Match Media, which is pretty cool. So Match Media is a JavaScript API that lets you test out a media query. So you can be like window.matchmedia and then say max width 768 pixels. And that will basically return true. And then you can, with, you know, in script, basically turn off functionality or something. So use that as a toggle as well.
Right. Have you heard anything about, I kind of liked the idea of like JavaScript detecting when they happen. So you only, the problem with that is, so you have max width 768 in your CSS and you have max width 768 in your JavaScript. You had to write that twice.
Yeah, yeah.
And maintain that twice. So it'd be kind of cool if you set it only once in CSS and then JavaScript like would get a callback or something when it changes. Is there anything you've heard of that's going that direction?
So in Match Media, you can add listeners to those. So you would have to essentially duplicate. I think ideal in that, well, maybe I don't know. So you do have a listener, that you can set up and get notified. It would also be interesting to navigate the CSSOM. I don't remember how media queries work inside the CSSOM, but I'm sure they're navigable, but it'd be interesting to add a listener directly on that so that you're basically browsing your style sheet in JavaScript, throw the listener on, and that way there's only a single copy. It's just, yeah, that'd be pretty cool. I don't know what the syntax would look like, though.
Yeah, okay. Right on. You got anything, Dave, for us on animations and responsive design?
Yeah, I mean, I think turning them off sounds good. Because you're just not going to notice them on an iPad or whatever. Like, it's going to move slow. Like, it's just probably not as performant as you'd like as right. It looked on the desktop.
In a lot of cases, you just want to treat iPad and iPhone and Android like you would i6 as far as like performance is concerned. Sure, it has more capability, but like the perf will be bad. So don't throw so much shiny at it.
Yeah. I mean, like, you can keep your like little sexy link covers, but just know they're going to be like covered up by a WebKit tap highlight.
Right.
Like a big black or pink in the case of modern Box. Or sorry, not modern, HTML5 boilerplate.
Hell yeah.
Heck yeah, yes.
Cool. So maybe here's one for the room. Maybe just do at media query for like 500 pixels max width, and then star, and then WebKit, or you know, all the different animation vendor prefixes, animation none important.
Boom.
Yeah.
Kill them
with some awful selector. That's anyway, that's just a way you could get around it without thinking about it too hard, though, is like just turn off all animations on everything.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Cool. I want to mention that this show is sponsored by, the first few ones here are sponsored by Less Accounting, lessaccounting.com. Some guys over there from Less Everything that do a bunch of apps, but Less Accounting is like a web-based, you know, keep your small business accounting in order app. Kind of like, you know, Quicken or whatever, but this has like less features, but is easier to use. So it's like, and Dave, like Dave said last week, it's important if you're in the business of taking money from folks and running a little small business, that keeping your accounting in the cloud is a darn good idea. So if you're in the market for an accounting, definitely check out lessaccounting.com.
Awesome. So the next question is from a CSS Tricks forum moderator. Chris, you want to read this one?
Yeah, sure. So thanks, Gray Gilmore, for sending this in. Yeah, he hangs out in the CSS Tricks forums a lot, so I want to shout out for that. He said, both of you guys, meaning me and Dave, and of course special guest Paul Irish, have an impressive web presence. So yeah, thanks for that.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, yeah, shucks.
He loves the community, and I love the community. I want to get back to work in that every day, but I found my contributions to the community a bit lacking. Where would you recommend somebody start contributing back? Write a jQuery plugin, write a WordPress plugin, or what do you think would be, you know, that would help the community and kind of help garner some reputation?
Man, this is a good question, good. I think.
Yeah, Paul. Yeah. I mean, Paul's like, that's like his life story, kind of, right? He helped on Modernizer and did some cool stuff for the community, and all of a sudden he's kind of got a dream job, as it were, at Google. So, I mean, clearly contributing back a little bit has its benefits.
Yeah, it totally does. I think this question is something that we've heard a lot. Not only, you know, we heard it in the jQuery community for a long time. Just in the larger web design and web development communities. And it's part of it's most of the reason why we created movetheWebForward.org and launched that last month or so. So I think, you know, things that he could consider are, so writing a jQuery plugin is rad and good. And I think that'd be a fun way to get something out there. Although it's hard these days to find something that hasn't been done.
Yeah, I recommend not doing it. I got the market cornered, and I kind of want to do it that way. And,
There's plenty to do as far as like. So we were just talking about exploring SVG in HTML, which is something that only more modern browsers can do, and styling it through CSS. That's something that we haven't seen a lot of people explore. And I would like, you know, I would love to see him write a blog post on that. There's a lot of other just kind of what are the extents of different CSS properties? A lot of the stuff that you see Matias Bienes do, which is basically understanding kind of how markup and CSS work at a more fundamental level, it's really interesting. And there's plenty of places to join existing projects and do research. So like finding out in Compass, for instance. If you use SAS, then you probably use Compass. And Compass has a lot of rules in there that may be – so they put in a bunch of vendor prefixes. And those vendor prefixes are targeting old legacy browsers. And as browsers remove their vendor prefixes and go to the standard property, those prefixes can kind of hang around and be doing no good at all. So people can jump in there and like find out what the current status of browser support is for each property and find a way to sunset those prefixes. So I think in every project, every decent sized project, there's a issue tracker of things that people want done. And I would just encourage anyone that wants to contribute to be assertive. Jump in there and just be like, I'm going to do stuff and let people know that and go at it. Don't ask to be asked. if you just jump in and are assertive and start doing work, everyone will love it and you'll be helping out a huge deal and certainly be raising your profile.
Cool.
Didn't you have a forum thread or like a GitHub issue, Paul, a while back, like stuff I want to see? And it was like Flames and SVG or something.
Yeah, totally. So I have a GitHub repo called Lazy Web Requests, and it's basically a bunch of projects that would help out web developers, essentially, all kind of weekend projects. Or there's things like working with the W3C on the CSS and the HTML validators, or developing a flexible and usable screenshotting service. There's stuff like that would just be awesome. But it really just takes one person to kind of commit to it and see it through. And so that's another place where you could definitely jump in.
I'd like to talk about Compass. That was cool. I'm like totally on the SaaS bandwagon recently, and I'm using it for just everything. And I'm not using Compass. And one of the reasons is because I like to write my own mixins because I like to decide what vendor prefixes I'm going to use and that type of thing, right? And that's basically what Compass provides. And so, God, that's interesting. If somebody would jump in, maybe. And write Compass that said, what exactly, tell me just like through a little JSON string or something, what browsers you want to support. And then Compass would tailor itself to the proper set of, if Compass has some weird stuff about like Moz opacity or something, because you're trying to support like Firefox 2, you know, that sucks. You know, like you could just tell Compass, hey, I don't want to support Firefox 2 anymore. And it would automatically remove that. That'd be pretty hot. What do you think about building that, Gray?
Totally. And I see like a year later when I sunset support for Firefox, I don't know, 12 a year later, I guess, then I want to be able to just update my JSON file for that, generate all my new CSS, and end up with a much smaller CSS payload. You know, that'd be rad.
Yes, it would. I like that idea on like apps too. Earlier we were talking about how that guy, feel free to name him, is doing that for jQuery and marking what is for what browser and everything.
Yeah,
That would be cool to write on any app. Like I wish I had that on some of my day job, you know, working at Wufoo and stuff. There's stuff in there that's specifically for browsers that we don't have an index of what code is for what. So when we finally make the call that, you know, X browser is going to be sunset, there's no easy index to go look at what code we can go now remove, you know. So anybody working on any app, I would, you know, in this, like, how fast browsers are moving, I would start writing that index right away. Like, did you do something specific for one browser? Write it down somewhere.
And I think starts by solving your own problems first is a big one. I mean, like, if you find yourself doing something over and over and over and it's really dumb, like, fix that and then release it as a plugin or, you know, whether that's WordPress, jQuery, or whatever. Just don't make up problems, I guess. Like, solve actual problems.
I like that. So Gray last night, this guy with the question that we're answering here, he has a blog, and he wrote up an article about WordPress that explains a little issue about how you deal with the homepage in WordPress. And I was like, dang, Gray, that's a nice post. I'm going to retweet the crap out of that. So, you know, hopefully it can help his reputation a little bit there. But it was like, you're already doing it. So he already knows, you know, like, nice. You know, how to do good stuff. Blogging, certainly a part of that. You know, like you have a little thing that was frustrating you and you wrote it up, shared it with the world, and you're going to go up from there. Let's move on.
Awesome. Yeah, the next one is another audio call-in from Brent, Mr. Brent. We don't have a last name, but here, let's...
I think it was Brent Trout.
Brent Trout?
I think so.
Now I'm hungry.
It's not spelled like that. T-R-A-U-T, I think. Anyway,
awesome. Play it up. Okay, here we go.
Hi, Shop Talk. My name is Brent, and I have a couple questions about multi-page versus single-page web design, and to what extent JavaScript should be used in each. I've created a lot of multi-page websites that are primarily HTML and CSS with a little JavaScript sprinkled in, and I've also created a few single-page websites that use a spectacular amount of JavaScript, and it seems clear to me that each one has its own benefits and detriments. My question is, when you start a new project, how do you decide which approach to take? Assuming that you're going to use a lot of JavaScript, do you traditionally use object-oriented patterns, or do you use HTML and use something like jQuery to fill in the blanks? When you make AJAX requests, do you traditionally use precompiled HTML from the back end, or do you send JSON data and, say, a template on the front end to generate your content? And then finally, which approach do you find more scalable, and which one is simpler and easier to develop? Thanks.
Pretty good question there. Kind of getting into a lot of different stuff. Anyone want a bite?
I'll take a shot. So this comes up a lot, which is what is the difference between a site and an app, and where is what I'm building along that kind of continuum? So I commonly think that when we talk about responsive design works really well with sites and not so well with apps, where you're probably going to define a completely different interface. So a blog is going to be on one of those multi-page sites kind of side of things. Whereas if I'm creating a to-do list app, that's going to be a single page app. I'm going to use templates for that, client-side templating. And I guess it is getting somewhat hard to decide where you lie along that continuum. GitHub is a good example of I think it's like a hybrid. There's a lot of interactivity and input and output on each of the pages, and so I would consider it a collection of apps. The issue tracker is very definitely an app. But a lot of the rest of it has so much interactivity. As you're browsing files, they're using push state. They're changing the URL, but they're loading the content in dynamically. And so it's a little hard to decide. And part of it is picking how much architecture are you going to set up to begin the project versus how much architecture are you going to introduce through your refactors as you kind of realize that things are growing in complexity? Those are essentially your two choices. And so you have to decide where your starting point is going to be. So you're certainly going to be dealing with the DOM, and you want to define how you're going to interact with it. I think most people are finding these days that as the requirements are growing, you take a look at the project that you just finished and you look at the JavaScript that you wrote. And if you feel like, it got pretty messy at the end, then clearly on your next project, you're going to start at a higher level of abstraction and start to use some better practices when it comes to templating, when it comes to maybe an MVC framework, and handle that in a more elegant way.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things he asked, what's easier? I feel like, let's say, you have an app and some event happens on the app and you need to like insert a new chunk of stuff on the page. So you need, you're using JavaScript to do some DOM manipulation stuff to get that stuff on the page. Let's say you AJAX request it. Well, you're needing a library for that probably, because that's a pain in the ass without it. But where does that chunk come from? Maybe it's, maybe your backend framework kind of generates it. And he asked, do you use pre-formatted HTML for that? I would say yes, and that's easier. That generally you're like, I need this new chunk. Let's have the backend serve up that chunk to insert. Or maybe it's just a static HTML file somewhere, something that's easy to grab and insert that new chunk. Generally, that's where I start, you know, because I just feel like that's easy. I'll just describe exactly what I want, and then I'll get that stuff. Versus serving up some JSON and then making a template, and you, then you'll need some kind of mini library to deal with templating for you. And I feel like going the templating route is more complicated. And are you for sure going to get value out of that? Like, if you choose to go the templating route, is it guaranteed that that's better and smarter? I don't necessarily think so. I think in a lot of cases it is, because, you know, maybe your HTML changes. It's kind of a bummer then later if you're like, oh, I need to change some classes and IDs on this stuff. It's easier to change it in a template than it is to change it, you know, theoretically in lots of different places. But it's just one of those things you'll have to ask you, like, how have you gone both routes in the past and found one ended up kind of messy or what, you know?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's basically a trade-off of like, how is it easy for me to do it right now versus what is it going to look like 1 month out when I have, you know, three people on my team working on this and we need to maintain it. And I think very often the questions for those two things can be different. And so it's hard to choose which is the right direction and how high of an abstraction you want to shoot for to begin with.
Yeah, definitely no one right answer to that. Okay, I mean, that was a complicated question, Brent. I bet in the history of Shop Talk we'll revisit that, those kind of things, because there's so many things that like all web development questions kind of circle around, and that's one of them. Okay.
That's a good one.
That's the end of my collection of ones that I knew were going to be good for Paul Land. And we're coming up on 45 minutes anyway, right? So maybe we should.
Yeah. So maybe this will be the last one. Does that sound good? Just one last one, and then we'll wrap it up.
Not overdo it.
Here we go. This one's maybe an easy one, but it could be kind of like a hot topic. This is from, I'm going to murder the first name, Pelletier Emmanuel. Did I do okay? All right.
Pelletier, that like some Pelletier. It's French, but my last name ends in ER and it's not a.
Coyer. Okay, I frequently see that lots of websites don't put styles on active links. I personally think it's a crucial style to add on websites in order to have good UX. But seeing so many websites, big or small, without styling active links, I'm wondering, maybe I'm wrong. What do you think on parentheses not styling active links in terms of web design, experience, accessibility, and all that?
Well, here's one for you. I think maybe what he means, he might mean active, but I think it's more common to see not styled focus link. Active is the state at which your mouse button is clicked down. So it like in a button state, it looks like the button is clicked. Everybody does hover, you know, because maybe that'll change in the future. But for now, Everybody styles a hover link. And then active link is the press down one, which is a nice little feedback that you've clicked that button. So I see those three more commonly than I see focus. And focus being like if you tab to the link. So that being like the important accessibility one, which usually I pair up with hover.
Yep.
Right, so I guess
we did see some of it in like when Samurai started designing some of the button style links, where like as I click, like the button looks depressed, and that's a fine use of active link. However, I have seen like plenty of cases where someone does kind of a relative position shift in active state to make it feel like the link was depressed. Mm-hmm. And it kind of weirds me out a little bit. Like if it's gonna look like a button, then depressing that button makes sense. But if it's just a textual link, like there's nothing to push down. So a position shift is very awkward to me.
What he's talking about is doing like A:active and then doing position relative top one pixel or something like that. So it pushes the thing. I was a offender of that. I thought it was cool for a minute and I don't do it anymore, but I did think it was cool for a minute until I had lots of problems with, just chucking position relative on any anchor link with hover on it or active on it can get wacky. Is that any link you have that happens to be, say, absolutely positioned, all of a sudden it flips to relative and just zooms away or something. It can cause problems. So anyway, not here to Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, like, the focus one is important. I always forget that, and it's super important to have that. But the active one, man, I tend to not use it only because I'd rather see the page next page load faster. like the clue that the link has been clicked is that the page loads. That's kind of where I put my focus. But I don't know, maybe an active state is good, but with as fast as browsers are now, I think it's less important.
Thierry reminds us in the chat room that IE6 doesn't do focus, so active is important there. So good. So we won't have any errata there.
IE6, come on.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. I care about the fact, but not the browser.
The fact is interesting.
That's a good. It's a good fact. Come to Shop Talk for awesome facts.
Guys, wait, can I ask? Okay, so let's say, so we last week was essentially IE6 died because Microsoft said it died and it's dead, whatever. Essentially, yeah, I think everyone agrees that from a browser share perspective, IE6 is totally dead. It's under 1% everywhere, and there's really no reason to invest a lot of time. So
this is before Microsoft has pushed out the auto-updating.
There's that. Yeah, there's that story. How do you guys feel? What do you do for IE6? Do you guys just don't even check it and it could look terrible, or do you handle it a different way?
We check it still, but yeah, only because we're using something like IE Tester and it's just a click of a button to bring it back up.
So are you going to remove all layout and so that you're not doing work, or are you making your IE6 appear as though your IE8 does?
No, not to that degree. Not at all. I mean, we just make sure it
works. You can read stuff.
Yeah. Text enters the page. We try to, I mean, you know, you want to have, you, I think you, if you've been coding for a long time, you've kind of learned what not to do, box model wise. So, we kind of just make sure we code smart enough to where it will still work. But, I think don't worry about it. And then wasn't somebody saying IE7 is at 3%? So should we even worry about that?
I mean, if you care about IE7, my opinion now is basically that I'm going to serve a very nicely designed print style sheet to the screen for IE6, 7, and 8. And so it's essentially what Andy Clark did with the IE6 Universal Style Sheet a while ago. Mm-hmm. And so give old IE a print edition. And it will have the content, but no column layout, no anything, just the content. And then I'm going to forget about it. And I'm going to focus my efforts on browsers that have media query support.
And again, that's a blog. So in the spectrum of app to blog or app to content or whatever, that's good. I do that on CSS Tricks for 6 and 7. You get the Andy Clark's IE6 thing. It's a fine way to do it. And then in the app world, it's a little different. At Wufoo, we still look at IE6, not for the app itself. We are on IE7 for that, but the public forums that you create, third-party content, is all IE6. Pretty much everything works. It's a, there's, rounded corners. Who cares about that? But as far as functionality. Anyway, and to avoid some further errata, somebody pointed out that Compass does have some flags that you can set for turning off specific features in specific browsers and stuff. So we were talking about how that would be cool. That kind of exists, not quite exactly how I described it, but there's some flags you can set.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Man.
Mike Fowler.
This IRC chat room is paying off in dividends. It's free chat room. Wow. This is great. Okay.
Any last words, folks, you want to mention?
Well, Paul, how can people get in touch with you, follow you, read all your stuff, use all your stuff? What's the best way?
You know what? Follow me on GitHub. It's actually that's my new recommendation. I've actually given up reading Twitter for 2012 so far. So I'll post to it and I'll check my mentions once every 2 days. but I'm not reading my stream, and it's so nice. It's so nice.
You're better than me.
Oh, it's just, it takes a lot of work, or it takes a lot of like dedication to maintain that. But, and I'm on Google Plus and I post there as well. But most people aren't there anymore. It's kind of sad. I do really like the format of having so much space. So I do post there too. And I'm active on GitHub. So, there as well as my blog. So those are the places.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul.
Which would be paulirish.com. So
.com.
Just in case. Okay. I guess that wraps it up, folks. I'll work on my slap bass thing. It sounded better in the shower than it did. It's some like reverberation or something. It sounds lame when I do it now, so.
No, and then for our outro, we'll rewind it like that bass solo in that Paul. Yeah, exactly. That'll be our outro. So. Sweet. Well, hey, everyone, thanks for listening and tuning in. We had tons of listeners from all over the globe listening, so that was awesome. And thanks for everyone in the IRC chat room supplying us with facts. And we'll be back next week. So thanks, everybody.
ShopTalkShow.com.
Peace. Stop.